Black women they were doing what they were supposed to have done for a long time, which was fight together against white supremacy, against racism. And they were doing this with the civil rights movement. So what happened, people had to come in and infiltrate and have a divide and conquer strategy between black men and black women. In 1964, government came in and they pulled black women to the side, and they started to classify black women and women in general as minorities. In 1964, that's the first time they classified women as minorities. So they started to give them set asides and benefits, and then they created the feminist movement. And a lot of sisters branched off into that, and that kind of created a rift because a lot of sisters stopped fighting for civil rights and they started to fight for women's rights. But women's rights weren't being jeopardized in the black community. Our first priority was racism, and we should have dealt with that first.
We wanted to be free. We didn't need any boundaries. We need no man to tell us what to do.
Well, we hadn't had no man to tell us what to do anyway. You couldn't tell us what to do. It was slavery, so who, you know, we didn't really have no fight with you about that. That was the white woman fight with her man, but we took it on. I want to be free. Ain't nobody going to tell me what to do. And then women started having babies, what they call out of wedlock, and then that got to be okay, too. Oh, all right. Once it got accepted by society, all of the rest of the people, then it was okay then to just have a baby. In fact, I don't even want to have another bunch to just have a baby. And then we start saying, oh, I'm going to be the mother and the father. All kind of nonsense. And so what happened was that movement, and there never was a sisterhood, the women's liberation movement between the black woman and the white woman.
Because you have to understand, in the tactic of the art of war, when you want to destroy a stronger enemy, you have to get rid of the cultural perspective of authority. So what you do, you have to destroy the man in the society. And that's exactly what they did. I talk about this in my book. You have to destroy the masculine principle, which is the head of the family. That's part of it. The other part is to get rid of the environment and the ways and means for the head or the authority of that family to become and stay the authority and the head of that family, and that is to be the provider and the protector. Take away his means of providing. Take away his means of protecting his family, and he no longer has any rights or any kind of power. So when you have done that, you have now undermined the glue that keeps the family together.
It's a difference between a woman.
Looking at the question, what is culture, Horton and Horton Hunt said, from their life experiences, a group develops a set of rules and procedures for meeting their needs. The set of rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas and values is called a culture. To a great extent, you see, a culture involves a set of rules and a procedure for meeting needs. And this is the thing we have to keep in mind. You don't have a culture just to have a culture. And you don't claim a culture just because it's a culture or just because it's African. The ultimate thing that culture must do is solve problems. That's why people evolve a culture. That's why a culture comes into existence as a way of what? Solving problems and meeting needs. That's why at a certain point, when a culture no longer meets the needs of a people or solves the problem confronting a people, that culture must be transformed. There's nothing sacred about holding the culture in the face of, you know, new events and new changes. Unless, of course, you're free to do that if you're willing also to accept suicide or death. And you have that right to that choice. You know, we have the right to say, look, we're going to hold on to this culture even if it kills us. But we should be what? Very conscious of our decision. We should not be holding on to it out of a misunderstanding of what culture is supposed to do. Ultimately, culture is supposed to solve problems and to meet the needs of the people. And a culture then has to be measured against those standards. Does this culture meet our needs? Does it solve our problems? Chancellor Weaver since then looked at the African cultures, looked at African characteristics, and looked at them in terms of in what way did they meet our needs and in what way did they deal with the slave trade and colonialism and the other kind of things that happened to us as African people. And after going through that, then he set up what? The plan, which a lot of people don't read. Which is the whole point of what? It's the whole point of the book. Not the first part, but really the second part. Looking at our culture and our history critically, he then, and looking at our situation and where we are today as a result of that history and of those cultures, he then draws out a map for a plan, a way for us to what? Get out of our situation and to restore African civilization and to restore African people. But it's at that point most people sort of move on to something else. This is the place you must study. We're going to include that in our pilot studies, by the way, that plan along with some others. To set some rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas. Cultures are not just ways people sing and dance and what they eat and how they dress and the rituals and so forth that they perform. These ways of behaving and dressing and so forth are based on sets of ideas and values. And ultimately, in a deeper sense, it's this set of ideas and values that lay the basis for culture. Cluckhorn and anthropologists indicated that culture is all the, and he defined culture as all the historically created designs for living, explicit and implicit, rational, irrational, and non-rational, which may exist at any given time as a potential guide, as potential guides for the behavior of man, for the behavior of the people. In other words, culture creates designs as a result of its history for living and provides guides for its members, guides for behaving. As a set of guides for designing, for guiding the behavior of its members, a culture provides standards of proper cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conduct. Culture provides a set of norms and concepts of what is to be expected to exist, why we expect them to exist. Though culture is a product of actual experience, culture is essentially ideological, meaning that it essentially exists in the mind, because culture ultimately is based on the sharing of beliefs and customs and expectations. We receive our culture as a result of, as a part of our social heritage, to the degree that the individual identifies or is at one with this culture, and to the degree to which the members of a culture identify with it, culture is represented in the minds of its people. In other words, we have to recognize deeply that culture cannot exist outside of ourselves. It only can exist in our minds and in our bodies as a people. And therefore, to a great extent, it is ideological more than it is physical, more than it is behavioral, more than it is just ways of dressing. Ultimately, a culture must be represented in the very minds of a people. And it is only through its representation as a mental entity that a people can identify with the culture. A culture is a way of thinking, a way of attending the world, of perceiving the world, of classifying and categorizing the world, of ordering the world, of processing information, and of evaluating the world. When we say then that the Europeans decultured us or distorted our culture, we are also saying then that the Europeans have distorted our modes of attending the world, our modes of experiencing the world, our modes of classifying and categorizing the world, our modes of processing information that comes from the world. So there's no little wonder then that we are having problems in what some people call education, particularly as it is European, Eurocentrically designed, that our children are perceived as having problems in thinking skills and math skills and science skills and so forth. Because ultimately, you see, culture provides you with a frame for thinking. It provides you with a structure for organizing information, for classifying information, for evaluating information, you see, for processing information. And when you distort a people's culture, then you distort their capacity to appropriately organize information and deal with it. And this is what has happened to us. This is the reason why I say again and again that the problem of education in terms of the problems our children have in schools are not education problems. They are political. They only express themselves as educational problems. The problems our children may have in paying attention, thinking so-called logically, categorizing, classifying, in terms of vocabulary and so forth, are really not academic problems. They are cultural problems, and they are the result of political interactions. Because in transforming our sense of who we are, what we are, and in transforming our culture, so was our thinking and so forth transformed as well. This is why ultimately the educational problems of our people who have to be solved in terms of cultural transformation, not just in terms of educational technique, you see. And this is what the White Strata lay on us. You know, we're going to discover finally that great reading technique. Children can learn almost in any way you teach them. But it's about more than technique. It must be a part of a total cultural structure. And the children must come with a cultural intentionality. Because no technique is going to matter if they pay no mind, if they have no interest. You see, if that culture has given them little or no reason for learning what is to be taught, if what they're learning is really not relevant to their situation and their circumstances. And so we have to understand very much how culture itself structures the thought processes. Now, there are some of you who are saying, but there are those of us who knew nothing about African culture, and we got all A's in school and so forth and so on. Remember this, though. We got these A's in school, and we went through these schools at the price of alienation. As chances is,
something that they had in Georgia, Atlanta, last year. I want to make that very clear. I had nothing whatsoever to do with the integrated.
In 1974 in Cairo on the peopling of Africa, and for the very first time, an international body invited Africans to have to say something about African history. Sheikh Anta Diop of Senegal and Theophile Obenga of the Congo. Diop presented a great number of arguments establishing the Africanness of Egyptian civilization, but the most important contribution he made, and very significant contribution, was the linguistic contribution. Diop established clearly and beyond the shadow of a doubt by showing thousands of intimate interconnections, familial interconnections between the languages of Africa and the Egyptian language, that it was structurally, fundamentally an African language, that it was not Afro-Semitic or Afro-Hamitic or Afro-Asiatic or Afro-anything, it was African. And one of the things that stands out in our memory is what UNESCO had to say at the end of that conference in their report, that although they had asked, they had made it quite clear to all the delegates that they should come well-prepared, well-researched, because this was to be a turning point. Many things were to be decided after two centuries of debate. Only two gentlemen turned up, they said, with well-researched papers. And who were those gentlemen? The Africans, Theophile Obenga and Sheikh Anta Diop. There were at that conference many brilliant Europeans, some of them Africanists, not just Eurocentric Europeans, many of them in the Ops Corner. But everybody came expecting to repeat themselves because they thought that in spite of all the controversy, this was a decided and settled matter. I don't think ever again they will come unprepared when men like Diop, Obenga, and others whom you shall hear this weekend, I don't think that when these men appear, other people will come unprepared again. Because we have been taken too long for granted. And for the first time, for the first real time, we are not alone. We have built a school of thinking, and we have built scholars who are becoming more and more informed and responsible. No longer the idle, hollow boast of the past. Now everything we say, or most of what we say, most of us can establish it on hard, solid ground. And what we come here tonight to do, my intention here tonight, is not to seek to undermine the achievements and accomplishments of other people, but to show in very real sense, not only were we the creators of Egyptian civilization, but that our equality in the world, the equality of the black peoples of the world, is not built on any biblical fantasy or any liberal sentiment. It is rooted in hard, concrete, historical reality.
We are the esteemed scholar, teacher, and healer. Dr. Francis Chris Welty, and some of you may know, Dr. Welty is a behavioral scientist and psychiatrist who has practiced in the D.C. area for the last 50 years. One of the most widely recognized works known as the CREST theory of color confrontation and racism was developed in the late 1960s, revolutionized the way we conceptualize racism, white supremacy. Through this theory, Dr. Welty provided a framework by which we could describe and explain the pathological behavior and actions that have been perpetrated against us as a people, and helps us understand how racism, white supremacy manifests itself in our area of people and history. Dr. Welty has some new books. I think the keys to the cover, which she has on sale here this evening as well, and she will be back. Not only are the techniques by which to decode racism and white supremacy, but she also covers an enduring problem among us, the crisis in black male-female relationships. Today, Dr. Welty will outline for you what has caused the crisis in our relationships and provide tools on how to repair our relationships. We ask that you open your mind and really digest valuable education that Dr. Welty has come to impart upon us today. And from all lectures, you should come away from more.
Black is a genetically dominant trait. And the darker you are, the more genetic power you have to produce this pigment. So the next thing we were taught, if you're black, with a whole lot, get back. A little bit less if you're brown, than brown. If you're yellow, you're mellow. And if you're white, no pigment. You're all right. Now, see, black people and people of color all over the world, I can go to London, England, and say this, and everybody knows black, yellow, black, brown, brown, yellow, mellow, white, right, because under white domination and under white supremacy, they taught us this by their behavior towards us.
Yes.
And programmed us to behave in that way in relationship to each other. and to begin to worship the fact that the grandmothers were raped. Are you all with me? Now, this is not for anybody to feel bad, but all of this instruction is based on maintaining this system of racism, white supremacy. And we need to understand that if I had Oprah Winfrey's money, I would get all of the crystal black people. And every year there would be a parade of the blackest people parading their beauty.
Brother Henry Louis Gates.
male-female relationship. It affects the relationship in this way. This whole system of racism, the goal objective is white genetic survival on this planet. White genetic survival. Now, a lot of people say, oh, no, it's all about economics. No, they use these areas of activity to make certain that there's white genetic survival. They make the money and use the money and dispense the money for the purpose of the system. The same is the distribution of education for the maintenance of the system of their survival. All over Europe today, when they talk about Islam and checkmating immigration, they are really talking about the flood of non-white people coming into Europe from Africa and causing what? White genetic annihilation. Now, mind you, they say they're going to do something about it. And how many people remember the case of the Norwegian man who killed nearly 70 people? And these were children of African and Asian ancestry who were in Norway. And he killed them because they were causing potentially white genetic annihilation. Now, they gave him a pass and said he had psychological problems. But he planned it well. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. And he carried it out. I said he wasn't mentally ill. He was engaging in white genetic survival by whatever necessary means. See, I say that standing your ground. Standing your ground, that means that don't any black person attempt standing your ground. Now, black people can engage in standing their ground when they are killing other black people. Because that is the white genetic survival by the destruction of black men. So that's, you can get a pass with that. But don't start thinking you're afraid of a police officer and you're going to stay in your ground. You see, well, that Trayvon stood his ground because he was afraid. No, those are the laws that are being put in place. It's just like when President Barack Obama became president. They had what they call the Obama effect. Now, the Obama effect was people buying more guns than had ever been bought at one time. Because just the very idea of a black man being in the White House was perceived as a threat. Just like the Republicans said, they didn't say we've got another plan to save the country. They said we have to make this black man fail. Our energy is going to be directed and focused on making him fail because he is a black man. Now let's go back about the relationship. Black females are not a threat to white genetic survival. Now, we have all the genetic material in our own, but women can entice, but they cannot impose sexual intercourse. In other words, imagine you reaching and pulling out your M16 rifle and saying to the man, you are going to have sex with her. Now, gentlemen, what will happen?
Who is the man?
He got flashed. woman, boy, and girl and baby. Some time ago, woman and girl was out. The woman and girl was out. Black men died, many of them. Don't call me no boy. So the white people said, fine, you got two choices. I mean, you got one choice left. Mate. Are you always?
Yeah.
Come on, because we're getting free.
Nile Valley, whatever, in Atlanta, Georgia, last year, September or October, whatever time it was. Truly, it was stated on radio, on television. It was written in papers. It was advertised by the group that I had to do, and it was a conference that I called. I want to make every one of you listening to me to make it very clear, I had nothing at all to do with that conference. And I think that should be the last time I should have to say that. I do call integrated conferences. Because I don't need any white man to endorse me. I call a conference of the Nile Valley, approximately 2 years ago, I called for a conference. It was in the Mount Zion Lutheran Church. I was speaking, no, I wasn't, I was attending a lecture that day, sponsored by the First World Alliance, and I asked that the parties involved have a Nile Valley conference, and I specified among African people only. African people participating in that conference. And I made it very clear. As a matter of fact, I reiterated three times that the participant must be African people. Now, some people make mistakes that African people also come from Europe. That is their problem. And if they need this constant certification by Europeans and feel that nothing we have can be conducted without the benefit of Europeans, they should not blame me for that or have me indicted for it. But I need to say for the last time, I had nothing to do with it then. I intended not to have anything to do with it. As a matter of fact, I didn't know when they planned it. I didn't know when they were selling their tickets with my name all over the newspaper. I knew nothing about it. I found out when my name was already propagandized everywhere that I was supposed to be participating. And after I sent a letter to the persons involved stating that they must cease or desist or take appropriate action to stop them, it is then that they stopped using my name in the paper and in their advertisement, but continue to use it in the radio. When I persisted on that also, it is then that they decided to take other action of evasion and stated that I was to attend the conference, but I couldn't because I was very ill, and they didn't know if I would survive. Then that didn't work, and they said I was stuck in Egypt and could not arrive for the conference. Neither of these things is true. The fact is, I didn't want any association with the Europeans that bring, and the people who attended it, and the people who put it on, I will say again, I don't want no association with them now. The fact is that I don't consider them African. So it must be made clear. I don't think it could be any doubt. Anyone who had anything to do with the establishment of the conference, I do not consider an African and will not associate with. I wouldn't even give them the privilege of coming to my toilet to be in there. So those people who participated and started it and have to have Europeans, I have nothing to do with it at all. So the moon could get back, and I don't give a damn what they think about it, and that's it. There would be no association with me and them. It is time that African people be responsible for African And it was stated that if I meant that well for African people, then I would have participated. Unfortunately, the individual and individual stated that forgot. But I did not start my attitude about Africa in 1984. It was in 1936 when I wrote, and 1938 when I published my first book on Africa. One has to remember, I was 18 and a half years of age when I found out that there was no woman like a black woman. I've never touched any other woman since and before but a black woman. All of my children are by black women, three black women. I got to make it very clear. I married all three. The first one died, left me with six. The second one died, left me with four more. And my present wife left have two. I've been married. And I've been married to this present wife 38 years. And going another few more. And if this one should die and I don't want it to happen, I will get me another black wife within 6 months. But I don't think that you all should have any difficulty in understanding me. So when black folks question, when black folks make statements, you could say without any hitch, you know that isn't so. But by letting you know who the person that you're dealing with. And that's from 1938 to now. I have yet to go to bed with my first white woman. And if I didn't go before, you know I'm not going now. I don't want to get AIDS. Don't want AIDS. And so they never have to tell you that a monkey bit any black person that caused me to get AIDS. But these things been brought up the way. I'm trying to clear these the way so that you could see. Now, I can't say that for many of black folks who have gone out and trying to get back home. I have gone out and married to a white woman and trying to get back home. So those who whine on me must understand I am not coming back to be reunited with black folks. I've never gone out and left black folks. You see, so this must be clear. So when they're questioning my attitude towards the Nile Valley, I think that I have as much right to be about the Nile Valley since it is that I have been an African from the beginning to the present and hope to be that to the day I die. I could now take time on dealing with you about Africa, and the Nile Valley in particular. There's another tour we are going on the 22nd of December, and that people are even questioning, why are we going to the Nile Valley constantly and not to Nigeria or Egypt or Liberia or any of the other places in West Africa? That should be quite common knowledge. I am not going to the Nile Valley by accident. It is by intent. I do not go to West Africa by accident. That too is by intent. We have 1,000, probably 1,000,000 African writers. African writers on the West African situation. Every time you look around and see a black man or a woman writing, it's about the slave trade. I am tired of slave trade. Other things about our life than the slave trade. Not that the slave trade wasn't an important part in our lifestyle, but there's an aspect of the slave trade I wish that we could get rid of. And that's the biggest lie of all. All of us walking around talking about our African brother who sold us into slavery. We're the only people who have ever been in slavery by an enemy that charged our own self with the slavery and can't support it. Everybody here walking around with this damn nonsense about African settlers trying to save it can't give you the name of the king, can't give you the name of the country or the period of time in which this took place. So I don't want to be another one to be added to this nonsense. I go to the Nile Valley because it is the foundation of man's society. And it is something that you must know. Many of you must have come from church today, the Christian church. Many of you yesterday came from the Hebrew church, call it Hebrew Israelite or whatever Israelite you want to call it.
for me to care. Since you may have misunderstood me, whether you're Christian, Muslim, Jew, Hebrew, Israelite, whatever idol you want to be, you're nothing but a poor copy of what your African ancestors did along the Nile. And that's why I carry people about the Nile. It makes no difference to me if you're an Arab. If you're an Arab, he had slaves, mentally or physically. If you're a Muslim slave, if your master is an Arab, or your master, if you're a Christian slave, and your master is a European, or your master is any other form of education, an African who is enslaved to an master from another group is still as enslaved as the other. You can't tell me because you're Islamic, you're less enslaved than a Christian or Hebrew. I got rid of the one that I was brought up in. Got rid of it quick and not quick enough. And I have to tell the rabbi, and it seems to be that. So those of you who think that by being Muslim, you're somebody special, or by being Christian, you're somebody special, or by being Hebrew Israelite, you're somebody, you're just jiving yourself. A slave, an African slave, for any ism other than African, praying that when you want to quit one group of European things or one group of Arab things, you get another one. You jump from the pot to the fire and believe it's an escape. Let us deal with it. First of all, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam believe in a world that started with two people called Adam and Eve. That's just yesterday. It is like saying that you had a mother and a father, but you had no grandmother and no grandfather. So when you're talking about Adam and Eve, you're talking about something just 2 days ago. You say that Adam and Eve, the world, is only 6,000 years old. But I go to grave. I go to grave. Triple that in age. 15, 18,000 years the grave being there. I go to tomb of
what is your birth? It brings chaos into order. It brings order to chaos. That's what culture does. Culture does. You're not understanding that. It binds us to each other. It gives us identity. It gives us a reason for surviving. That it tells us who we should live for and who we should die for in the afterlife. Culture is an energy source for thriving. And it gives us a sense of security. It also puts us into a system of accountability. We are accountable to our ancestors. Now, when you're looking at all of that, and it is a petri dish. So that African culture becomes a petri dish, it produces
patterns.
It cultivates African, and no other culture can make that statement. Here, no other culture. Only African culture.
Right.
If we look at culture like this and see it as a means by which a people protect themselves, then we could understand culture as the immune system of a people and cultivate that immune system, right? Now what does the immune system do? The immune system, you have the T cells, you got the lymph nodes, they become a warrior, right? It allows it to recognize the antigen, or antigen is a foreign body which threatens the health of the whole. That's how you get that to be short. Because they're not the neutron, Genetic memory, if you read the medical journal, is connected to immunity. So that there are these memory cells which carry the knowledge and information about how to defeat the disease. I'm gonna cut this right. Okay, so what happened? You got the Ma'aka. Remember the Ma'aka?
Yeah.
Ma'aka that great disaster.
turn all your images right. And they told you everything that looked good was right. And they made you believe it, and they convinced you that this was true. They remove you from the respectful commentary of the history of the world. And they went through the textbooks and they told you that everything of endearment in the world belonged to them. And they stole one third of a continent. They stole the whole Nile Valley from you. They stole Egypt from you. And they stole the social thought of Egypt, because out of this Nile Valley you created the social thought that went into the making of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and laid the foundation for the three major religions of the world. All of them came out of that valley. They don't want to give you this, because if you understood this, you would understand there's no such thing as Greek philosophy. Yes. There's no such thing as a Greek fraternity. These silly black people talk about Greek love fraternities won't belong to any of them. You look silly. Alpha Kappa Alpha. You won't belong to any of them. You'd be embarrassed. The Greeks had no fraternity, had no architect, so they stole it from out of Africa. You understand all of this if you understood what blacks contributed to that in that great Nile Valley, and how they awakened that other valley, the Tigris and the Euphrates, and gave life to the world long before the first European warship.
So what's the African
thing of this African? It's depressed the psyche to the point where he thought he had to copy something for someone else. And the Europeans and the Asians, we haven't dealt with what the East Asians did to us before the Europeans got there. We haven't dealt with the East Asian slave trade was 800 years old before the Europeans got there. We haven't dealt with the fact that the Arab slave trade drained us of so much organization and so much energy. Had it not been for that slave trade, we would have had enough organization and energy to resist the European slave trade.
Having said that tone,
we have certainly, over the years, seen television programs, miniseries, dramas that relate to the story, the experience, if you will, of our people through the Middle Passage. Taking what you've indicated here one step further and moving to America, the result of the sort of slave trade that you're talking about, for Dr. Marion Stalin, Dr. Stalin, what do you think was going through the minds of our sisters who were seeing their men killed and their children taken away from them?
The African woman saw chaos that she was helpless to change. Her children were dragged from her, and she herself frequently was dragged along with it. There was nothing the African woman could do to stop this horrendous movement toward actually bringing wealth to the Europeans by the stealing of health, of labor, and therefore making their fortune in the New World.
Mm-hmm. Sister Sonia, listening to this, you brought up the psyche just a moment ago, and I'm attempting here for us to put together the experience in Africa, the experience in America. How do you view what this must have been like within the psyche, if you will, of us as a people in this country? How does that affect us?
I think that's a very good question, Gary. And I think I once had a class of mine in creative writing do a writing from these people who were in their houses, their cabins, their huts, whatever, and people brought to them something and said, here, and threw it on the ground and said, cook it. It was chicken, as we know it today, but once upon a time, in terms of an African mentality, when it was put there, it was not chicken, as we now call it today, but it was something that they must have walked around, and I could see women, African women walking around and looking at it, what is this? What is this stuff? What is it they want us to put into our minds and our bodies and our spirits? What is the stuff that is here? And I could see them walk around and walk around and walk around, and finally came and touched it and withdrew from it and touched it again and said, but we must survive. We must be. And they took it and made it, and we call it chitlins, people. We call it chitlins. We live and survive. And that's what I'm talking about, family. And in our psyche, yes, we made something, and that's what we've done. We made a delicacy out of being black in this country. Isn't that something?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a break for just one moment. We're going to come back and we're going to resume the journey, Black Family Unity. The journey moves on through slavery and see exactly how the family survived it when we return after this.
Seem to be generally unaware that they had a history, that they were told that they had achieved nothing.
This man says the true facts are to be found in a more thorough and honest look at history. After Dr. Chancellor Williams, a native of Bennettsville, South Carolina, received his doctorate in history and sociology, he studied psychology, anthropology, archaeology, and economics. He also taught Arabic history and worked as a professor of history at Howard University for 29 years. He won an award from the Black Academy of Arts and Letters and was the first recipient of the 21st Century Foundation's Clarence L. Hope Prize for Excellence in Literature.
Of course, the record was there to show that much of Western civilization was built upon the foundation of the land where civilization itself had gone. And this was in Africa. Therefore, the focus had to be on Africa to see to what extent the recent revelation at the turn of the century, at the turn of the century, that Africa was the cradle of civilization. To what extent could this be actually verified? And so my work was directed in the uncovering much of what had been lost, much of what had been disguised, much of what had been stolen, refurbished, reworked, and presented to Western civilization as the work brought from Africa, but presented to Western civilization as the creation of Western man.
Dr. Chancellor Williams spent 16 years writing his book, and although a piece of extraordinary research, he considered it a greater miracle that he was able to get it published. Plagued by a chronic lack of funds and turned down by his academic associates and all other sources, Dr. Williams mortgaged his home. Then another obstacle arose. Due to his rapidly failing eyesight, he was forced to abandon his earlier plans for an expanded three-volume work and had to settle for a condensed version of his research into a single volume, the book we now know as The Destruction of Black Civilization, Great Issues of a Race, from 4,500 B.C. to 2,000 A.D. What did you find out about ancient African civilizations?
Well, to begin with, I found out that ancient African civilization was, first of all, the beginning of civilization. I found out that there could be no record found anywhere that antedates the advanced civilization of Africa. And this was the finding of European and other scholars. And they were now gradually admitted it, and when the evidence became overwhelming, the question arose, could Africans have achieved all of this? Could Africans have achieved this remarkable work infection that could be traced back for thousands of years before Christ, or before Western civilization had even started? Could Africans have done this? Could Africans have achieved this high advance in mathematics, in physics, in chemistry, in medicine, and so forth? I mean, many of the things we now glorify as modern. Take the Washington Monument, for example, which is an exact duplication of ancient African architecture, which is well known. And most of the columns you see on the stately columns on buildings, which the Greeks, in studying in Africa, are borrowed from the Africans, remodeled them at Doria, at Corinth, and so forth, gave these columns the name of the city in which they remodeled them and gave them a Greek cap. They really didn't do much changing. They merely removed the apple and the campus leaf of the column and modified it, but otherwise it was substantially the same as Africa.
Dr. Williams, were there ever laws and rules that governed the entire continent of Africa?
There were laws and rules that governed the entire continent in the same sense that you have the same system of laws and rules that which govern a whole people without at the same time having a single government, a single state spreading over a whole continent, the second largest. In other words, I'm saying that while Africa, in contradistinction to being a country with the second largest continent on earth, while the African people at one time in history occupied the whole continent, and while they were one people in their general culture, in their general religion, with certain modifications, in their general social law, in their general legal system, right on down the line, in almost every avenue you could find that there was this kinship. The only thing that they fundamentally different, or where they fundamentally differed, was where, of course, when they divided up and formed separate states, or withdrew, or formed separate societies, and developed different languages from the segmentation or separation from what had been a larger language group. So that there's no problem at all in understanding that you had one people occupying the continent without being under one single state.
Dr. Williams, based on your research of history, is it accurate that democracy was born in Greece?
No. Democracy was not born in any one place. The record, as I indicate in the discussion on the chapter dealing with the African Constitution, Birth of Democracy, and Birth of Democracy in Africa, I made it quite clear that democracy was a system that was natural among the Asian people in all stages of development, even the most primitive society, had their chiefs generally elected, and the chiefs were generally subject to the will of the group. So it was nothing unusual about the head of the society being subject to the will of the tribe, which was one of the early forms of social organization. The family, the clan, the tribe, the nation. So that in Africa, you will find that back in times immemorial, they had this their own system of democracy. And it was this same system which could be found in every part of the African continent. The same fundamental law, the same fundamental custom, no matter whether it was 5,000 miles apart, no matter whether the group had never come across the other group, they had the same system. That's why we know that we were dealing with substantially one people. So that democracy then was so long, so many thousands of years before Greece, that the mention of Greece in connection with where democracy began could only bring smiles to the face of any scholar who has really studied world history.
What were some of the specific African cultures, civilizations?
These civilizations, I refer to them, of course, generally as the great kingdoms and the great or the empires that existed all over the continent of Africa. To the south, perhaps the greatest, at least one of the greatest, was the empire of Monmouthtaba, of which President Zimbabwe is a part of what was once a much larger empire. And then, of course, those empires of Mali and of Ghana, ancient Ghana, and of Songhai, and of the Mossi state, and so on. Many of these countries had started in a period long before Christ was born. Ghana, for example, had over 400 kings listed before Christ was born. So these were ancient empires. The most important thing here, though, to note about these empires that I last named, is that all the people in America, all the blacks or Africans in America, came from this area of great nation, of a great educational system, where the greatest university of the time in which these slaves were being brought to America still was flourishing in its glory. That is, of course, the University of Sankore. The great civilizations in Nigeria, all of these were advanced cultures. So these people didn't come, as they were told, and came to believe after they were lost memory of their homeland by the system of not allowing people of the same language group to be sold to the same plantation, but scattering them all over the South so that you wouldn't form a power base by having a lot of Africans speaking the same language. So this helped by this breakdown of intercommunication among themselves, helped them to lose memory. But we were told, quite to the contrary, that we were from a land of savages, of cannibals. And except by the grace of God and the white man, we were with the lowest people. So we should be on our knees forever praying and thanking God that we were born, even in slavery, to this land to escape the horrors of Africa. And this was brought in and drilled into generation after generation. Until even today, after going through the earth, going through graduate school, the majority of blacks today reject the idea of being called an Afro-American.
Dr. Williams, if all the things you say are true, if Africans had such advanced civilization, hundreds of kings and one African king and one kingdom before Jesus Christ was born, how did Africans worldwide and Afro-Americans get in the shape they're in? How did these great kingdoms, this great civilization, fall to civilizations that were didn't come along until thousands of years after theirs were already established?
Well, it wasn't done overnight. Their great empires were built through their industry, through their enterprise, through their industry in so many fields, and the whole society, as I point out in the book, in fact, all of them, were organized even larger. This was the organization of workers, but they regard themselves as craftsmen. And each working group, whether it was building boats, or whether they were stonemasons or brickmasons, or whether they were carpenters or whatnot, each craft was organized into a lodge. In fact, the educational system was similarly organized on a basis of three levels. And so you had a society that waiting for production. The people who were specialized in growing rice or cotton or pepper or what have you. And so, not as Africans do today, Africans hardly get Africans generally today on a subsistence level. Just enough themselves, those are scared to produce a surplus for export and to sell the areas in which do not produce the same things which they produce and buy from the other people. The things which the other people produce and which they don't have, which is trade, which is progress, which is the basis of wealth. Worldwide, see what they're talking about, Reaganism, that's a religion thing. The Africans were doing that tens of thousands of years ago, a system of life. So they had regular trading posts, establishing different villages in other countries. They had trading routes across the Sahara into other lands. There's merchandise, camels loaded with merchandise or spices, whatever the people would do. They were an industrious people. And they sold, and they would import as well as export. And this is what made them great. I try to emphasize it. When you talk about the great African empire, they didn't just become great overnight, just great. No, they became great by doing specific things. They were great people. They were industrious people. They were builders. They were producers. The whole nation was fired to produce, and they were rewarded for their work. And so they built cities and so forth and so forth. And so this is why you had this great system of nations of building becoming so mighty. Now, why did they fall? They fell when this began to decline internally, and when the forces, the external forces, over centuries of effort, finally gained the day. These nations had lost, with laws, foreigners from coming to the interior in the same system of gradually settling around the border, that is foreign traders. And supposed to be traders, but most of them were geographers and others representing the foreign, but would establish those trading posts just ask the permission establish trade posts on the border. We don't want to come in. We don't come in because we just want to do business with you. We want to sell you what we have. We want to buy some of what you have. Well, the Africans are great traders, always great traders. So that was one of the reasons. They allowed them to settle along the border, one thing. The second thing that happened, and this went on, as I point out, in the destruction, for several thousand years before the certain countries were finally taken. And when they were taken, like Egypt, look how many times Egypt was taken and retaken.
You say black people of Egypt. Are you saying the Egyptians were black?
Of course they were black. The name comes from the name itself. As an origin in the name of the black king. So that it became either the Egyptians were black until it became otherwise. They're not black today. And those who occupy the northern part of the Sudan are not black today. They are partly Arab, mostly Arab, and some of them are mixed with Afro-Arabs, you might call it.
You spend quite a bit of time in your book describing the ancient civilization of Ethiopia. What is it you find important about that civilization?
Well, the ancient civilization of Ethiopia was the civilization of what we're talking about when we talk about that whole stretch of land from the Mediterranean to the source of the Nile, which was ancient Ethiopia. So Egypt was nothing but what we call Egypt now, which was Chem before the name was changed. Was nothing but a northern province of the Ethiopian Empire.
You have a chapter here, Ethiopia's oldest daughter, Egypt. And I'd like to read you a statement you made and get you to comment on it. You say, the melting pot of the races began around the northern perimeter. The end result was always the same. The blacks were pushed to the bottom of the social, economical, and political ladder, whenever and wherever the Asians and their mulatto offspring gained control. Why is that? Why with this advanced African civilization, when they interfaced with members of other groups, why did the members of that civilization always end up on the bottom of the ladder?
We have always been, as I repeatedly point out, the race of brotherhood seekers. We have been the ones who forever have carried on the drive for brotherhood with other people. They have never sought brotherhood with us, never, except for speed, where they saw an opportunity to play the role of big brother for a while they gained effective control. Now, they're cunning. They study us, and they know this. They have certain basic advantages. They can easily win our confidence, first of all, because Africa, the whole continent of Africa, was known as the land of the religious people. We didn't start all this religion in America, being more religious than the whites. No. This is an African characteristic. We were known from ancient times as the land of the spiritual people, the land of the God, because we were so religious, the blameless people, homeless road. We were so religious. So this must be kept in mind in Mr. General appraisal.
How significant was the oral historian in the reconstruction of African history?
Well, the story is indispensable if you're going to make a comparative study of history, in which you're going to compare what has been written, and since it's always written by foreigners, with what the Africans themselves had written in the records of their mind, and the records in the records of their mind turned out to be
as accurate as unerring in many respects as what is written in books.
Hey,
what's up, MJ?
But it doesn't pull at your heartstrings. Are there other ways in which we psychologically are removed as because we are not an immigrant population, but we are a population of people who were pushed off the continent?
You seem to think of nationhood.
Well, as African Americans, you might not be able to grasp that there's a particular nation on a continent that we gravitate to, but we do claim the entire continent. Okay, that's one thing we do. And then there are certain examples that we may claim more closely. Like in recent memory, when Nelson Mandela is walking out of prison, okay, as a free man, and then begins to move toward transforming South Africa, or helping transform South Africa. That's a moment that all of us share. Haile Gebrselassie wins the marathon in New York. He's in Ethiopia. But African Americans look at that and say, that's a black man running the New York Marathon. So it's not, I wouldn't say that it's something that we don't. We can't link to this. We link to everything that comes out of that.
One other thing I was going to say, I was just thinking about it. When you're saying the whole continent of Africa, it would be easier maybe if you hang with people from one certain country, and then you can learn their culture and the tribes and things they do in one country, because the whole continent has different countries and there's different cultures. Even in one country, you find that there's different things that are done by different tribes. So if you concentrate on one country, it'll be easier for you to kind of connect with what they do in that country. Or here in the United States, have friends that can teach you their culture from their country, I think. So kind of help.
What about the issue of a lot of immigrant communities have issues now of raising kids and the Americanization of those children? Terry, you sort of indicated, and Bologna as well, that perhaps part of that issue is going backward in time to teach our youth about their culture relative to the African experience, and then getting a sense or a connection. Does that work? Can it work? I know that the Boston community is really having a hard time right now because their kids are so Americanized that they're having difficulty with behavior.
I've seen it work, and I believe it can work because I've seen it work. It takes how you present it also. You have to present it in the context that people are living today, that our youth are living today, and where they can understand its necessity and its viability. Why is it important? How can it help them today in 2010? Let's understand culture gives us at least three things: identity, purpose, and direction. It lets the people know who they are in the world, how they relate to other people in the world. It tells them what they need to be about, their purpose. And it gives them a way to go about living their life. It gives them direction. It's those three things culture gives.
I'd like to say something about the Americanization. America's having problems with bringing up mature, responsible adults simply because of the way that American culture, you know, the way that it is.
So it's no different for the immigrant population.
Well, it's hard for the immigrant population because that's not their center. But they come to America hoping for a better life, you know, looking to create a better life for themselves and for their families. But because in America, America has a different set of things that America thinks is important. And so children grow up, any child growing up in America is going to be exposed to American thinking, American beauty standards, American ideas of what is important, like materialism, you know, acquiring a lot of things. It's one of the things that's a feature of American culture, you know, whoever dies with the most toys wins kind of thing, you know, and which is counter to many cultures, many other cultures. Many other cultures value family, the relationships between parents and children, and close family ties, working together. A lot of cultures have that as a lot of other people have that as part of their everyday life. But in America, individualism, rugged individualism, you know, and when children come up in that, then that is part of what creates the gap between parents and their children, because parents are going, where did this come from? It's part of what happens when you come to America.
Wow. I know that the lectures were long, lonely long, and I'm glad you guys were able to bear with me. Greetings to all of you, all our BTR family. Welcome to another Thursday edition of Let's Talk with Eric Jackson. Mr. Talk, as you guys know, won't be in today, but he will be back very soon. So I know a lot of you guys are going to be looking forward to that. So I'll be filling in temporarily, and, you know, this is Cloud Nation, broadcasting live and direct. You guys were listening to a couple of the black collar scholars as we dug into family dynamics, culture, kinship, identity, and origin. I was trying to take a cue from the wise elders that was giving me some insight on getting some better tools, so to speak, and resources to make sure that we navigate through this a lot smoother. And as you guys know, every family needs a vision, so to speak, a clearly defined framework as a map to navigate, you know, every you know, everything, to navigate each invested member towards the big picture, you know, goals on the whole. So, you know, wealth creation isn't, for example, some accidental anomaly. In fact, for many, it's a strategically crafted, well-calculated goal and initiative. And I believe that it's the same way with family in many cases, that it has to be calculated, strategized, crafted in a goal, in whether it's intentionally, which is the preference, or it's just something that's innate that some just do because it's part of the incubator of consciousness, which is their family, their household, and that has created that type of environment. Now, we looked at a variety of different challenges that families all around the world are facing, and some of those were things like, you know, anti-culture, divorce, you know, the busyness, absentee father figures, lack of discipline, financial pressures, lack of communication, negative media influences, balance of work and family, and materialism. Another one that was brought up, a few that were brought up were single mothers in poverty, teen pregnancy was brought up, which I'm going to speak on that. Mothers working without adequate child care was brought up. Child abuse, neglect, you know, loveless parenting, and aimless family vision structure. Family violence, poverty and unemployment, again, substance abuse, inadequate housing, inadequate role modeling, and high levels of family stress, along with economic difficulties, failed school systems, and inadequate labor market, incentives to abandon original culture and family structure, and internal division between husband and wife on family division. All these were mentioned as problems for the family, that potential problems for families. And so with all that being said, let's look at some of the positives for a second. And some of those positives, obviously, is, when you have strong communities, for example, that's a big deal. In fact, strong communities are comprised of strong families, I believe. And like the old African proverb, I do believe that it takes a village to raise a child. And in understanding this, we cannot overlook a variety of different things. And one of those things we can't overlook the impact of wise elders. We were talking about that yesterday. We can't overlook the impact of wise elders, but also the compassion of nurturing mothers, the creativity of youth and young children, or the leadership that men of purpose provide. Now, our economics are very important, and that goes without being said. We also have to recognize that without an environment that encourages wisdom, original culture, and original consciousness, economics will only be an improvement for the faithful few who do have those positive traits, who have that original consciousness, that original purpose indoctrinated in them, and they're not willowing away on false ideologies and deceptive ideologies that really are designed to stagnate and oppress specific family structures and divide them and create this continuum of dysfunctionality in cycles, repetitious cycles. Now, this isn't an indictment on communities or our community, in fact, nor is it the placement of blame. But this is simply an attempt to have an honest discussion with our beloved community. You know, one of the things I always believe that if change isn't intentional, how can change ever occur? And, you know, there are many well-meaning men and women who are championing progress for our communities and our families. But in many cases, oftentimes, they may lack the manpower and the resources. And there are also those who use their melanin as a gateway to profit off of others like us. And so we're saying all that, balancing life and successfully laying a foundation for a legacy, building family can be a challenging task. Is something that we've had to recognize. And so every family, I believe, needs that vision. Like I said, a clearly defined framework as a map to navigate each invested member towards the big picture goals of the whole. And it should be strategically crafted, well calculated, focusing on the goals and the initiatives that will propel them forward in that direction. And now I give an example of myself when we talk about being out of balance in some cases. You know, overcommitting or undercommitting can create huge problems in any family or community. And, I'll be the first to use myself as an example. And my vocation allows me to code and to write software from anywhere. And it also is a primary way for me to earn a wage, earn capital. So, for me, there's a group of brothers in Gary, Indiana, specifically, that known as the EFE, which is Entrepreneurs for Education. And they brought me on specifically to collaborate to deal with part of the youth, so to speak, you know, as part of their manhood class and development organization that they have as a consultant and a teacher, which means they also make sure that I would be compensated. They provided the resources that I, you know, that I need, the support mechanisms and finances that are necessary for me to do, you know, the job and the tasks that they employ me to do. And so I believe with that, like many of us, we all need the tools, you know, and we have to be intentional about not only getting whatever necessary information that we have that we need to be successful, but whenever we connect ourselves to, as everybody knows, it becomes a reflection of us. So we all have had experiences in life where we, you know, that helps to form and frame how we look at our perspectives on a lot of things. And so there are many cases where we may encounter scenarios where our time, our talent may be needed. But balancing family life and personal life, along with being able to contribute to the community, I would say, and this is just my opinion, it has to be balanced. So when you do it, obviously, you have to stay within your balance another, so that you can continue to be a productive contributor to whatever community that you're in. And if I think from my personal experience, if you take on too much at once, you know, then everything falls short. And so I personally make sure for myself that I don't overcommit or undercommit, because if I can't commit to something, I don't want to undercommit, and I don't want to overcommit and put myself in a position where I'm giving too much of and losing time in other areas. And so I say that to say that goes with that calculation that we're talking about, and being very calculated, very strategic, and embracing the wisdom that's available. Me personally, I'm constantly learning, so I would never consider myself in that pedestal of wise at this stage. But I am thankful and appreciative of the elders that I encounter, and the wisdom that they impart, and the life, you know, the life experience that they can contribute to any situation, in every case, including this show, where people bring wisdom on a regular basis, that, you know, me and my short-lived years, you know, can have no way of comparing to it, to what's been done already. And you know, and they say, you know, if, you know, to progress, you know, in a lot of areas, it just makes more sense to accelerate your life. I've always heard, you look for examples of those and people and situations where it's already been achieved, so that you can shorten that process and accelerate it for yourself. That's something I've been told. That's something I tell a lot of the guys that I talk to, the younger guys, to this day. So if you want to add to the discussion in any way, shape, or form, or want to speak on anything that you heard today, the call-in number is 347-838-8622. That, again, is 347-838-8622. You know, press number 1. To talk, and I hope you open up your mic so that you can contribute. The list of people that spoke earlier were Dr. Amos Wilson, Ivan Van Sertima, Dr. Francis Chris Weising, also Joseph Ben Jokanen, Maramba Anai, John Henry Clark, and also Dr. Chancellor Williams. They are all black scholars. We wanted to pull from their wisdom and really, really, you know, get on, be on point with everything. So I'm a, oh, I see one hand is open up, so I'll bring in Pianki. I don't know how long you've been waiting, but I'm going to try to let you in now. Give me 1 second. All right, your mic is open.
Yeah, where's everybody at?
Good question. I have absolutely no idea. I just know that we had a lot of guests that came by, and you know, they came in and they left. I guess the lectures were maybe a little too boring. I don't know.
Well, you know, these lectures happened a long time ago, and Dr. Ben's name is Yusuf Ben-Yakin, and Marimba Ani. You made some mispronunciation, but they happened a long time ago. One thing that stood out with Chancellor Williams is the fact that he had to come up with his own funding, even to the point of mortgaging his home in order to get his publication done. Those scholars always do meet some sort of tragedy in the ends of their life. Him and Dr. Clark going blind. I would say Dr. Clark was one of the most astute and best historians of all African and black Americans that we have produced. Very highly knowledgeable person. Had a large library, over 20,000 volumes, which is huge. I think he donated those to Schomburg. Dr. Ben donated his to the Nation of Islam for safekeeping. But would those messages go over today? I don't think they would. I think people have moved on. Should they be used as study? Yes, I think they should. It should be part of school's curriculum as pertaining to certain things. Would the lectures go over today? As I said before, I said I don't think they would. People have moved on with different interests and so forth. But a lot of good pertaining. You know, one thing I always had a problem with Chancellor Williams was the fact that he contradicted himself along his religious beliefs. The person that probably held sway more stated than any of them was Dr. Ben. And Amos Wilson was an excellent philosopher. His work should be part of curriculum for those schools that would include his Blueprint for Black Power, 800 pages, is a masterpiece, and have information today which can spur the ideas and ideologies of those who want to plan toward those endeavors. Give good examples which one can relate to today, very much true to it. Stories and incidents which you can relate to that has happened. For instance, dealing with the former Mayor Dinkins and New York and how the Korean Association affected him. So overall, I think it's pretty good. But as I said before, I don't think that those, you know, one thing about, for instance, some of them, they don't have any solutions. They put out the information to date. People have a tendency, not a tendency, but they know to ask for solutions. Not just the stories of the terrible things that happen, but people ask for solutions. Do we need to know about the terrible things that happen, or should we put more emphasis on solutions. I think you need to put more emphasis on solutions and taking advantage of the present situation that you have at hand, which is not advantage of nowhere near the degree that they should. I think I've said enough.
No, that, I think that was definitely valuable information. And I totally agree. I think, like in many cases with some of the people that I've got a chance to chat with, these are some of the people that we like to pull from, some of the scholars, and to we typically like to reexamine a lot of the successful things that happened, the movements of the people like the Black Wall Street movement, but also some of the a variety of different organizations that went forward in many ways and were successful in building specific types of ventures, whether it was things like farming or something. Like school, like different school systems, and some of the principles that people have done before. You mentioned a couple of the books that I like. That's how we all have talked about, Powernomics. We talked about, Henry Clark, and there's a long list of great, like you said, great solution oriented books out there that had. From people who have, done this before, way before I know people like myself. So I like to pull from those individuals and really case studies, as some would term it, but, real life examples of achievements that have taken place and how they've achieved it. And then also partnering with people who are achieving and using some of those principles even today. And it looks like we have somebody else who wants to get in, so let me find out who they are first and then see if we can let them, if we should let them in or not. Give me a second. Okay, so we found out it was a troll. It wasn't someone we could allow in, so unfortunately. But yeah, it's definitely been insightful. We're not broadcasting tomorrow, but hopefully, I think, if I'm not mistaken, sometime next week. That's when Mr. Talk will be back, if I'm not mistaken. So we're gonna get back into the swing of things, and back to the regularly scheduled programming and so forth. I know the show is coming to its close. Piyangi, did you have anything specific you wanted to add before we close out, or did you just want to do final words?
No, I didn't have anything specific, but that's like I said before. Those lectures that Dr. Clark used to do lectures every week in Harlem, and there's two gentlemen that I know that have probably all of them on videotape. One brother's name is Yusuf Adiz, and I can't pronounce the other person's name. Think of it. And even just what Theophile Bingle and Diop done at the 1972 and 1974 UNESCO symposium on the people of ancient Egypt. The peopling of ancient Egypt, which led UNESCO to produce an 8-volume work on Africa. Then there was W.E.D. Du Bois, who attempted to do, 7-volume on the history of Africa. I think I've got 3 volumes of what was accomplished. And I think that's where Henry Louis Gates got his idea to do the same, being sponsored by Harvard. I like Du Bois better. But there's a lot of works out there that one can mention, and especially those UNESCO, those 8 volumes, once you get those, it dispels a lot of information, especially on the notion of Africans selling people into slavery. They never did so for commercial gains, as is reported in Volume 2 or Volume 1. I forget which one. So it gives you something to target if that is your desire. Have at it. There's a lot of catching up that you got to do.
Oh yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot of stuff to sort through. But the good thing about it is, I personally enjoy it, and I like the reaction that a lot of the youth have when they get a hold of this information. It's exciting to watch them discover this information that's been locked away from them. A lot of them, I've noticed, people's behavior, even some that were, in the past tense, not the most well behaved, improve but not just that, the confidence that they seem to inherit once they begin to learn more and more about their history. It's something about discovering that there's more to life than what you see today, and learning more about.
One of my first books I got was produced by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I think it's Profiles in Courage. And he mentioned in one chapter about how he discovered some things he never knew and how he ran home in reading that book, that source of information, and was telling everybody else. But he had put out a real good book, which spawned my interest. And I used to go hang out in bookstores that had old books. We had one here in St. Louis. Used to be on Washington and 12th Street. Man, this is a huge place, man. You can go in there and stay a month. And I would literally scan and pick through every book volume that they had. I got some very old Bibles out of there. I have a collection of some volumes that was printed back in the early 1800s. Thoreau. I have Christopher Columbus' diaries. And, I used to love to get a hold of them old books. H.G. Wells and A History of America, and so on and so on and so on. And was a lot of information in there. Then also when you're studying, you have to make sure you go in the right direction, because you can go in the wrong direction. Because some people put out a bunch of what would prove later on to be was mistruths. That's why I get a kick out of people who espouse the Bible. I just chuckle from it. Don't never try to out-argue, because as soon as you out-argue one, there will be 20 outside your door studying, waiting their turn at you. It's never ending. It's something about ignorance. I think ignorance has a place in the universe just like anything else. And sometimes it can be in flick of virus or bacteria. But it's needed, because opposite of ignorance is knowledge. And when one goes against the other, the one that's best prepared, like was mentioned at this UNESCO symposium that was attended by Diop and Chekhov Diop. I'm sorry, Diop and Obinga. the commentary at the end said that those two brothers was better prepared than the rest. And then at some point in time, you have to go beyond being a what I call an armchair scholar. You need to dedicate time and effort to the profession of anthropology and paleontologist. Going out and doing like Toni Broder, and there's another black woman who's an anthropologist, or a paleontologist who's out actually leading excavations and digs, you know, in Ethiopia, other places, Egypt. A lot of this still continues to go on today in other areas where people find the remains of what you can literally call people's garbage, you know, wandering around, rooting around in people's garbage in order to find and get details on how they possibly live their life. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. Well, I mean, now we won't be broadcasting tomorrow. I wanted to remind everybody that. And I know we'll be back Monday. Have no idea what the topic will be, but I definitely know we'll definitely be back Monday. So love and hugs, you know, to everyone in the chat room, on the phone lines, and all the subscribers and archivers of the show. Because without you guys, as you already know, this wouldn't be possible. Remember everybody to come on back Monday, same time, same BTR channel. And enjoy your weekend, and we will hopefully see everybody back Monday. So that's it. You know, show's over, close the curtains, exit the building, another chapter in the book. Until next time, everybody have a joyous and peaceful day, and remember to continue to be awesome.